From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
Brothers and sisters,
vous voici en pèlerinage.
Here you are on pilgrimage.
À ce sanctuaire africain.
In this African sanctuary.
Témoin de tant d'humiliation à l'endroit de notre race.
Witness of humiliation of most of our brothers and sisters.
A look inside the West African slave trade at Gori Island in Senegal, the last stop of President Clinton's historic trip to Africa, and new revelations in the case of Comandante Everardo, the husband of American lawyer Jennifer Harbury, killed by the Guatemalan military on the payroll of the Central Intelligence Agency. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. A federal judge has thrown out Paula Jones' sexual harassment lawsuit against President Clinton. In a ruling that shocked both sides in the long-running case, U.S. District Judge Susan Weber Wright rejected all of Jones' claims stemming from her 1991 encounter with Clinton in a hotel suite, concluding that even if Clinton did proposition her crudely, it did not constitute sexual assault, and that she had not proven she was punished in the workplace or emotionally afflicted by Clinton for rebuffing him. The White House and its allies immediately rejoiced in what they saw as a momentous turning point, not only for the president's legal and political prospects, but also for his chances of shaping a favorable historical legacy. White House Press Secretary Mike McCurry said the president is pleased to receive the vindication that he's been waiting a long time for. But Jones' lawyers immediately signaled that they will appeal the dismissal, meaning months of additional legal maneuverings. Paula Jones spokeswoman Susan Carpenter McMillan says Jones is shocked by the dismissal of her lawsuit against President Clinton. Jones says Clinton exposed himself to her and asked for sex when he was Arkansas governor and she was a state employee. Carpenter McMillan says if that's not sexual harassment, then what is? Jones' attorneys say yesterday's ruling doesn't exonerate President Clinton. They say it only means a jury won't get to decide what the facts are unless Wright is overruled on appeal. Well, President Clinton is closing out his trip to Africa by paying respects at a monument to the continent's horrid slave-supplying past. Clinton was visiting Gori Island on Senegal's western coast to tour a former slave house and deliver a speech that outlines his vision for future U.S.-African, quote, partnerships. First Lady Hillary Rodham Clinton visited the island during her goodwill tour last year. Aides say they're uncertain about what Clinton might say on Gori, noting that he's spoken extemporaneously and from the heart throughout his 12 days in Africa. But they were quick to say the president would not issue an official apology for slavery, even though he came very close to it in Uganda by saying the United States wrongfully encouraged the slave trade with its demand for cheap labor. This news from Washington, China has agreed to release a noted dissident, Wang Dan, for medical reasons and send him into exile, this according to senior U.S. officials. The release is part of an agreement by the United States last month to drop sponsorship of a resolution condemning China's human rights policies. The U.S. officials confirmed the agreement for the release of Wang, which is expected to happen sometime before President Clinton goes to China for a summit meeting in late June. But they also said they were worried that premature publicity could harm the chances for Wang's release, since its timing is still under discussion with Beijing. Wang was a student leader of the Tiananmen Square democracy movement in 1989. He served 4 years in prison for his role in the demonstrations. He was arrested again May of 1995 and is serving an 11-year sentence in a northeast China prison for subversion. Nearly 1,000 Tibetans marched down New Delhi's busiest thoroughfare today, shouting their support for 6 hunger strikers protesting human rights abuses by China in the Himalayan region. The exiled Tibetan leader, the Dalai Lama, made an unannounced visit to the tent where the 6 have been staging their fast, now in its 24th day, where he told the hunger strikers he admired their determination. In a related development, China asked Japan to intervene to block a visit by the Dalai Lama, set to begin today, but there were no indications that Tokyo would comply. The strikers in New Delhi, led by 71-year-old Kun Sang, are demanding that the United Nations discuss the Chinese occupation of Tibet in the General Assembly, appoint a special representative to investigate human rights violations, and name a special envoy to Tibet. Pro-democracy leader Aung San Suu Kyi in Burma said the Burmese military government is still arresting people and committing human rights abuses, and she urged the international community to step up pressure on the government. In a videotaped speech smuggled out of Rangoon and represented to the United Nations Commission on Human Rights in Geneva, Suu Kyi said the situation had not improved since the government changed its name to the State Peace and Development Council instead of SLORC late last year. Suu Kyi was released from house arrest 6 years ago in July of 95. Says the military government has arrested about 100 people so far this year and estimates between 1,000 and 2,000 political prisoners are in Burmese jails. Finally, Maurice Papon, a former official of the pro-Nazi Vichy regime of France, who later became a French cabinet minister, was convicted today of complicity in crimes against humanity for arresting and deporting Jews during World War II. And that's some of the news. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, I'm Amy Goodman, joined by my co-host, Juan Gonzalez. Welcome, Juan.
Good day, Amy. And now that the Paula Jones case has gotten this amazing decision, maybe most of the media in America will have to get back to actually reporting some real news instead of continuing to apply these headlines with so little substance. All the problems that President Clinton has created in this country, of all of the problems, the Paula Jones situation is probably the least important.
Well, we'll see what happens because, in fact, this case is going to be appealed by her attorneys, and we'll see if an appeals court upholds this judgment by the Arkansas federal judge or sustains her decision. But at any rate, I guess President Clinton can come home now.
Yes, he's smiling all the way back across the, or will be smiling all the way back across the Atlantic.
Well, he was seen last night smoking a big cigar and playing a guitar in celebration. But we're going to stick with where President Clinton is right now for this segment. Clinton ends his 12-day tour of Africa with a tour and speech at Gori Island off the coast of Dakar, Senegal. Arguably one of the most significant visits of the president's six-nation tour in Africa. Gori Island was a European slave warehouse and trading post, as well as a military fortress. It was there that the slave ships docked and people from many parts of Africa were taken across the Atlantic, never to see home or family again. In just a few minutes, we're going to be joined by Malefi Kete-Asante, professor of Africology at Temple University in Philadelphia and founder of the Afrocentric School of Thought. We'll also be joined by a descendant of the Goris, and we'll find out who they were, Richard Harrison Gori, who's written a book on the subject, Gori Island, Island of No Return. But before we do that, we located a video on Gori Island, following a group of African Americans that went to this international symbol of repression and slavery. It's put out by Transatlantic Productions, based in Brooklyn, New York. And this is what a tour of Gori Island sounds like.
Okay, ready? So, brothers and sisters,
vous voici en pèlerinage.
Here you are on pilgrimage.
À ce sanctuaire africain.
In this African sanctuary.
Témoin de tant d'humiliation à l'endroit de notre race.
Witness of humiliation of most of our brothers and sisters.
Et l'actuelle maison date de 1776.
This house of slaves dates back from 1536.
Construite par les Hollandais.
Built by the Dutch.
La dernière esclaverie en date à Gori.
It was the last slavery house in Gori Island.
Parce que les premiers remontent à 1536.
Because the first one was built on 1536.
Construite par les Portugais.
Built by the Portuguese.
Premiers Européens à fouler le sol de Gori en 1444.
Was the first European to set the foot in Gori Island in 1444.
Gori était le centre de transit le plus important de l'Ouest africain.
Gori was the most important transit center in West Africa.
L'effectif dans cette maison variait entre 150 à 200 esclaves.
The effective in this house varied between 150 to 200 slaves.
Hommes, femmes, enfants.
Men, women and children.
L'attente très longue, presque de 3 mois.
The wait was too long because of 3 months.
Ces esclaves ayant affaire à des voiliers pour transport.
These slaves had had to deal with sailors for transportation.
Et des fois dans cette maison, toute la famille, le père, la mère et l'enfant séparés de cellules.
And here we used to find the whole family, father, mother and children in separate cells.
Pour partir, cela dépendait aussi des acquéreurs.
And in order to live, it used to depend on the slave traders.
Le père allant sur la Louisiane aux États-Unis.
The father going to Louisiana in the United States.
La mère au Brésil ou Cuba.
The mother in Brazil or Cuba.
L'enfant à Haïti ou les Antilles.
The children to Haiti or French Caribbean.
La séparation était totale.
So the separation was total.
Ils partaient d'ici sous des numéros matricules, jamais sous leurs noms africains.
They used to live here under the matricule numbers, never under the African names.
Et dans les plantations, ils optaient pour le nom de leur propre maître blanc.
And once in the plantations, they used to wear on their master's names.
Exemple, aux États-Unis, avec les Africains américains sous des noms anglais.
For example, in the United States, with African Americans who have English names.
Brésil, portugais.
Brazil, Portuguese names.
Cuba, espagnol.
Cuba, Spanish name.
Haïti, anti-français, nom ou prénom français.
Haïti or French Caribbean, French names.
Alors c'est donc des noms d'emprunt qu'ils ont actuellement et non des noms d'origine africaine.
So now they have borrowed names, not African names.
Et généralement dans cette maison, ces esclaves n'étaient libérés de leur chaîne qu'une fois par jour pour leur permettre de satisfaire leurs besoins.
And generally in this house they were usually freed only once daily for them to go to the bathroom.
Et généralement ils vivaient dans cette maison dans un état d'hygiène 0% que la première épidémie partit de ce lieu.
And they used to live in such bad conditions that the first epidemic plague which parted from in the island parted from here in 1779.
Alors c'était aussi un étrange marché où la valeur d'un enfant dépendait de sa denture faute d'état civil.
And it was a funny market where the value of a child depended upon his teeth.
La valeur d'une femme de ses seins, sa virginité.
The value of a lady upon her breast and her virginity. The value of a man depended upon his weight or his muscles.
Et puis au moment où vous allez aux
toilettes. A few of the chains they used to have between their ankles.
Alors,
when going to the bathroom.
Au milieu de la chaîne, il y avait une grosse poutre et l'autre que l'esclave était obligé de porter.
And between the chain, there used to be a big bowl that the slave used to bear in order to go to the bathroom.
The most time bound and whipped from Brazil to Mississippi, step out and tell your story. Those in Jamaica, in the fields of Cuba, in the swamps of Florida, the rice fields of South Carolina, you waiting Africans, step out and tell your story. Spirit of the dead, rise up. Lingering spirit of the dead, rise up and possess your bird of passage. From Alabama to Suriname, up to the caves of Louisiana, come out, you African spirits. Step out and claim your stories. You raped, slave bred, castrated, burned, tarred and feathered, roasted, chopped, lobotomized, bound and gagged, you African spirits, spirit of the dead, rise up, lingering spirit of the dead, rise up and possess your bird of passage.
Gray Island, off the coast of Senegal, where President Clinton will be making a speech today at the end of his historic Africa tour. You're listening to Democracy Now!, the beginning of that sound mix, a tour, actually, of Gray Island, produced by Transatlantic Productions. And then we moved into The Invocation from Sankofa, a film by Haile Gerima. Well, Juan, we're joined by two guests. We're joined by Molefe Kete-Asante, professor of Africology at Temple University, founder of the Afrocentric School of Thought, who's been to Gray Island more than 15 times, and Richard Harrison Gray. He is the author of Gray Island, Island of No Return, Saga of the Signers, a novel based on the history of Gray Island. Why don't we start with Richard Gray? You have done a history of Gray based on your family lineage. How do you know your family traces back to the island off of Senegal?
Well, I started with a picture of my great-grandfather, Harrison Gray. This was 25 years ago. And I was 17 years old, and I had this picture, and I seen the miniseries Roots. And I was inspired to do genealogical research. And as I studied about my great-grandfather, and I actually ran across a map dating back to 1677, and it illustrated a small island off the coast of West Africa. And it was very significant, a definite part of history that was untold. On many modern maps, the island did not appear, but on this specific map, there was a small island, and it had the same name as my last name, so I became very curious. And as I started researching, I found out about the history, the awesome history of Goree Island, and I found that the offsprings of the Europeans, men that controlled Goree Island, it was controlled by the Portuguese, the Dutch, the English, and the French at one time or other. And the offsprings from European men and African women, the girls specifically, were used as translators and negotiators for the slave trade. And as these girls evolved into women, they proposed to the slave trader, if you want to continue doing business with us, you have to give us half of what you get through the trade and eventually marry us. So what transpired from this, offsprings continued. And many times the European men did not give the last names to the children, the offsprings. So they became the inhabitants of the island. They became Goreans. And the history was very, very clear that these Goreans were a part of history that was untold. The island, the history of the island was untold. So as I actually took the footsteps backwards, I was able to trace the ancestry, my ancestry, back 350 years to the island of Goree.
What are the Signaires?
The word is pronounced Signares. The first inhabitants on Goree Island were the Portuguese, who came down the West African coast to explore and bring information back to Portugal and make maps. Well, when they came across Goree Island, they used it as a communication point, a warehouse point for trading goods and that sort of thing. The word signorita, signora, comes from the Spanish and the Portuguese. Well, as these women grew in popularity as being beautiful, shrewd businesswomen, the reputation and the name was given to them, signores, being of mixed bloodline, being noted for being shrewd, beautiful businesswomen.
And Richard Harrison, did you have much trouble once you had decided you wanted to do this book, being able to market it or to get publishers to interested in it?
Oh yes, because publishing companies were not at that time, and we're talking about in the last 10 years, they were not really focused upon African history in a publishing sense, and much less to say Goree Island. Not many people knew about Goree Island as a common, but we had a lot of historians, a lot of well-traveled individuals that had been over to Africa, that had experienced Goree Island, and they had made the same statement over and over again, that this is the most memorable place that I've ever been to. People like Brian Gumbel, Pope John Paul, Nelson Mandela. So Goree Island kept springing up. The history kept arising, and the publishing companies recognized that this was a historical event that needed to be talked about, and finally I was able to get published. And now, I mean, it's so great. I'm looking at ABC World News, and I see Joseph Njai, who has dedicated his life over 40 years in giving tours on the island of Goree and telling the history of Goree Island. Now it's finally being recognized. I mean, it's a very emotional day for me to see President Clinton on the island and telling the story.
Professor Malefiketi Asante, you've been there more than a dozen times. We have played your speeches on Democracy Now! As you talk about the Middle Passage and slavery. Start off by just talking about the significance of Goree Island.
Well, I think it's very good to hear Richard talk about Joseph Njai, because in 1972, the tape that you played at the beginning of the show, I heard Joseph Njai, and it had a powerful impact on me. He's now 74 years old. He's a riveting speaker. He is perhaps one of the best learned men about the whole slavery situation from Goree. However, I always like to tell people that we have to put Goree into a larger context in this sense, that there were more than 300 such slave fortresses along the coast of Africa. In fact, in Ghana alone, there were more than 30. And in fact, the Cape Coast Castle, as they call it, and the Elmina Fortress in Ghana are so large that they would make maybe 10 times the size of the Goree house that the president is visiting. So Goree has, of course, it has great history because it is almost like one of those points where when you enter Africa, you go to Goree. But we must also understand that there were many Gorees. There was Weta, there was Badagry, there was Bonny, as well as Elmina and Cape Coast and all of the fortresses along the Angola coastline. So for me, however, the fact that President Clinton has decided to stop there, as Richard Harrison's Goree was just saying, where many people, Kissinger, Muhammad Ali, everyone has gone, is important because he will see, of course, the door of no return. And there were many of these doors along the Atlantic Ocean that Africans went through to get onto ships to be transported away from their homelands to the Americas, both North and South America as well as the Caribbean.
Professor Malefiquete Asante and Richard Harrison Goree, we have to break for stations to identify themselves. When we come back, we'll continue our discussion. Also, at the end of the show, we'll be speaking with Jennifer Harbury about new documents on the CIA and her husband's death. Stay with us.
Old pirates, yes, they rob I. Sold I to the merchant ship. Then after they took I, threw I in their dungeons and pit. But my hand was made strong by the works of the Almighty to forward in this generation triumphantly. So won't you help me sing these songs of freedom? That's all I ever had. Redemption song, redemption song. Emancipate yourselves from mental slavery. None but ourselves can free our minds.
You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez, that Bunny Wailer's redemption song of Bob Marley.
And this boat is from the 18th century. By chance, we found it down here.
Alors donc c'est cette boule qui est au milieu de la chaîne que l'esclave portait pour satisfaire ses besoins.
And this is the boat that the slave used to wear on between his ankles when going to the bathroom.
Son poids de 10 kg 300.
Its weight is 10 kg 300. 10 kg 0.3. From Bordeaux in France.
18th siècle.
18th century.
Nous l'avons reçu, ça fait 3 ans.
We got it three years ago.
Avec sa clé.
With its key.
Alors cet anneau était destiné à la cheville de l'esclave.
That's what the slave had used to have between his ankles. Between his ankles. You don't have to lock it. Don't lock it.
again a tour of Goree Island. I didn't even realize you're saying, Professor Malefe Ketiasante and Richard Harrison Goree, our guests, that this is Joseph Njai who is doing this tour?
Yes, Joseph Njai. And Joseph Njai, of course, is now, as I said, 74 years old, but he has been doing this, as Richard pointed out, for more than 40 years.
Well, Professor Molefi Ketiasante, I'd like to ask you, in terms of the signatis that Richardson Harrison Goree has been writing about, you often hear in the United States conservative whites say, well, the slave trade involved so many Africans who were also participating in it. How can you put it on racism or white society? How would you respond to that and the role of the intermediaries that developed in the slave trade?
One, we must not forget that the European belief at the time was in the non-humanity of Africans, not even inferiority, simply that Africans were not humans. And given that belief, anything was possible. And of course, that belief never was a belief that Africans had toward other Africans. And I always like to point out that nowhere in Africa, at least in terms of West Africa at that moment in time in history, is there any evidence where slavery was the principal mode of production of an African economy or state? However, there were situations such as Richard Harrison Goree just pointed out with the Signatics that you would have African collaborators. There were many Africans who collaborated with Europeans. But the concept, the idea of taking African labor and transporting African labor across the ocean to the Americas was not an African idea. It was a European initiative.
And who were the Africans who were enslaved? Can you tell us what nations?
There were more than 100 different African ethnic groups that were brought to the Americas, including this is a very good question because I met Professor John Hope Franklin for the first time in Goree, and one of the things that we talked about was the fact that you had many different ethnic groups. You had the Wolof, you had the Mandinka, you had the Ewe, the Yoruba, the Igbo, the Asante, the Fanti, the Congo people, the Ngola people, the Serer, the Tukulor. There were many, many different ethnic groups, all speaking different languages, all with different concepts of societies and traditions and different ancestors, all placed many times coming through Goree or coming through a Weta, a Bani, or any of these other sites, but coming through one port, being, as they said, warehoused for several months sometimes until ships would come, and then placed on those ships and taken away. Many people died, of course, even in the so-called warehouses. And, of course, many people died en route on the ships. And, of course, many people died when we reached the land in the Americas. So the whole process of the enslavement of the African people was really one of physical dislocation in the sense that people were sometimes taken from the interior and brought down to the coast, and then not only there, but was taken thousands of miles away. And I have always argued that the physical dislocation was really, in a sense, a metaphor for what would be a more powerful dislocation, which was mental or cultural or psychological dislocation, which we see now, and which, of course, Joseph Njai always talks about when he says that we didn't leave Africa with Portuguese or Spanish or English or French names, that these names are borrowed names, that that's not the way Africans left. We left with African names, and when we landed in Virginia or South Carolina or Cuba or Haiti or Puerto Rico or Mexico, wherever we landed, when we landed, we were then given new names, and those names were not African names, and so consequently, the physical dislocation really was a model for what would be a more serious mental and psychological dislocation, which we still today are seeing the results and the impacts of in the African population on this side of the ocean.
Richard Harrison Gore, I'd like to ask you, I was fascinated by your mentioning that what got you interested in doing this research initially was having seen Roots, the television, the Alex Haley series some 25 years ago. It's hard to believe that it's been 25 years since that first appeared on television, but I remember it well as having an incredible impact on the nation as a whole. But since then, obviously, television is no longer producing those kinds of shows that really look into the history of the United States in such a vivid manner. Could you talk a little bit about the impact that had on you and maybe Professor Asante about what impact Roots had in terms of this whole issue of the study of African history and African American history?
As a young black man and watching Roots on television, it inspired me to do genealogical research. And that was something that a lot of people had never heard about before. And as I did my genealogical research, I started having visions from God for doing a novel, doing a visual piece, such as Alex Haley did with Roots, to portray the history. Not in a documentary type form, but maybe a more colorful type form. The novel that I have written shows the history of Africa, the history of Gore Island. It talks about the tribal customs that Dr. Asante talks about. It talks about the young mulatto girl that grows up on the island of Gore and deals with the powers that hold Gore and she's still in charge of her own destiny. So, you know, it was a great impact for me, and I know for much of the world. So it put us more in tune with our African tribal bloodline, and I think a lot of people went searching at that point. Tourism grew. People wanted to know.
Professor Malefe Kete-Asante of Temple University.
Yes, and I just think, Amy, I just want to say that Roots also, it had an impact on everyone, and I think that what Alex Haley told was a narrative of family, and that had never been told in such a individual, personal way, and it did have a tremendous impact, because what it also said to us was that at places like Gore, we experienced the awful sense of loss, and we didn't know how deep that loss was. Our names, our languages, our customs, our traditions, our colors and fabrics, in fact, our whole minds, you know, our minds indeed. So what Alex Haley did was to give back to us, to return to us, this sense of narrative of family that we could all sort of share in, even if we did not, if we were not able, like Richard Harrison Gore, to go back to a specific lineage and say, well, this is my lineage, or this is where I came from. We were able to know that no African slaves ever left Africa. Only African people left Africa. And the African people who left were merchants. They were farmers. They were blacksmiths. They were potters. They were musicians. They were court emissaries. They were members of royal families. We knew that because Alex had given us this narrative of family that we all could somehow see how we were, dislocated and displaced and decentered in the whole historical process of our arrival in the Americas.
And so, Professor Malefe Kete-Asante, what is your assessment now of President Clinton's trip to Africa? Do you feel that the American people have learned some of what you're talking about? And what about his approaching an apology in Uganda, and what would you like to see happen next?
Well, I think this is a good question. I think it's a momentous visit, and I think it's a necessary visit. I think it was useful. I think it's going to have a tremendous impact on the American public. Hopefully, I think it will also, in a strange sort of way, it will have an impact on the African-American population, because Africans, even though there are many of us who have been going to Africa and go to Africa all the time, many African Americans have, because of this dislocation, been scared of Africa. So now that the president is gone, I think this will have a tremendous impact on that. Now, I don't think an apology is the main thing. What I would like to see is a memorial. See, I think that what this country has never done, and this is what the African American population is always talking about, and I think this is why this whole question of apology came up. People are saying, look, you know, for 246 years you enslaved African people. After 1865, African people were free. There was no apology on the part of the United States. There was no memorial. There was nothing to say that these African people had been done, that an injustice had been done. Why can't the nation, instead of making an apology, create a major memorial around the whole process of how African people were uprooted from the continent of Africa and brought to the Americas? And maybe a memorial might be a much more practical thing to do, and a much more significant thing to do than an apology.
Well, of course, at the same time that President Clinton is finishing his trip in Africa, we're hearing how out of California the reversal of affirmative action has severely reduced the numbers of African Americans and Latinos that are attending schools like Berkeley and UCLA. And I wonder, the memorial sounds to me something that would definitely create a movement or could spawn a movement. But what about the issue of actual reparations? Do you think
that the issue
of reparations is something that could still be raised and won in this country?
One, you know, I am a believer in reparations. I think the reparations would deal with two problems. It will deal with the anger in the African American population, and it would deal with the guilt of the white population. And because once reparations are done, we may not even be talking about money. We may be talking about saying that African Americans should be able to go to school for 100 years in this country free to any college. We may be talking about some other way of trying to overcome the deficit that has occurred because African people were uprooted and given nothing and were not even allowed to learn how to read or write for 246 years. So there's a big problem, and I think that we start talking about reparations, we have to also open up the Native American question and the Latino question as well, because I think that there's reparations that'll do there just as much.
It also seems that an apology, a formal apology, is the first official admittance that there was a wrong done and that there is responsibility taken, which would be the groundwork you need before reparations are given.
Amy, you may be correct. I think, however, that the apology issue also comes because I think the Pope has been apologizing all around the world. And I think that that's one of the reasons people raise it in regards to the American president. But because the Pope has done, I think the Pope has made an attempt to speak on behalf of the Catholic Church in terms of what he has seen as the participation in some of the problems that have existed over the years. And I think that the American government has not really really done that.
Well, I want to thank you both for being with us, and I want to say that I got a hold of Gore Island, Island of No Return, Richard Harrison Gore's book. I first saw it at the Museum of African American History in Detroit, where we're speaking to Richard Harrison Gore, where he lives, and that is quite a monument to the history of African Americans, and we don't see anything like that in Washington, D.C.
We don't have anything like it in the country.
That's right. I want to thank you both for joining us, Professor Malefe Keteasante, Professor of Africology at Temple University and founder of the Afrocentric School of Thought, and Richard Harrison Gore, descended from the inhabitants of Gore. His book is called Gore Island, Island of No Return, Saga of the Signores, and it is published by Goldleaf Press. And if you have trouble getting it, as we did, there is a phone number for Goldleaf, which is in Michigan, and it's 810-954-0192. I'll give you the 800 number. That's 1-800-838-8854, toll-free 1-800-838-8854. And before stations identify themselves and we go to that official one-minute break, we wanted to play for you a song that Tony Bird wrote. He's actually from Malawi, called Sorry Africa. No, this isn't President Clinton singing and playing on his saxophone. This is Tony Bird. Take a listen.
Oh, Africa, nobody ever apologized for when your blood ran red and your country was stolen by the whites. They took your land and your home and shut you down when you tried to refuse. But I'm sorry, Africa, I'm sorry for my people, I'm sorry what they did to you. And Africa, nobody ever said it was wrong, though you cried long and loud in your pain when your life was gone. But no one cared, they took you slaves and changed your life and your culture too. But I'm sorry, Africa, I'm sorry for my people, I'm sorry what they did to you. Oh, sorry, Africa, oh, sorry, Africa, oh, sorry, Africa, oh, sorry, Africa, oh, sorry, Africa. I'm sorry for my people, I'm sorry what they did to you. And Africa, history's ghosts are blind and mute. Your wars and past still cry, but today just began anew. Now they're your friends, but the tears still linger. And of course my song cannot undo. But I'm sorry, Africa, I'm sorry for my people, I'm sorry what they did to you. And Africa, still today your blood tears are fall as you struggle to discover just who you are in our world. Despotic traitors squeeze your new lands, foreigners invade you while droughts torture you. But I'm sorry, Africa, I'm sorry for my people, I'm sorry what they left to you.
You're listening to Tony Bird singing Sorry Africa. He is a white African from Malawi. If you'd like a copy of today's show, you can call 1-800-735-0230. That's ordering a cassette from the Pacifica Archives at 1-800-735-0230. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, and we'll be back in a minute.
And Africa, still today the hate goes on. With South Africa shooting up the racist gun. The apartheid lie denies you life, and they jail, rob, kill and divide you. But I'm sorry, Africa, I'm sorry for my people, I'm sorry what they're doing to you. And Africa, I too am an African crying. I'm a child of a white, born into your time so trying. But I'm ashamed of my racist brothers, and I nearly fell by their hatred too. I'm just sorry, Africa, I'm sorry for my people, I'm sorry what they're doing to you. Oh, sorry, Africa.
You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, and that CD, Sorry Africa, by Tony Bird, is brought to you by Island Records. I'm Amy Goodman here with Juan Gonzalez as we move on today to another issue. American lawyer Jennifer Harbury has captured worldwide attention in her long and courageous search to discover what happened to her husband, Mayan guerrilla comandante Efrain Bamaca Velasquez, also known as Everardo. He was captured and disappeared by the U.S.-backed Guatemalan military in the 1980s after a long campaign and serious opposition from both the Guatemalan and U.S. governments. She discovered in 1995 that her husband was dead, tortured and killed by Guatemalan military on the payroll of the CIA. But now she's uncovered new information about the role of the United States in the death of her husband. And Jennifer Harbury joins us in Pacifica Station WPFW studios. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Jennifer.
Well, thanks, Amy, and thanks for that great program on Gory Island. I really enjoyed that.
Well, we thank all the people here who helped put that together, and also especially to Richard Goray and Malefe Kete Asante. Jennifer, why don't you start? For listeners who aren't familiar with the case of Comandante Everardo, your husband, by telling us what happened when and then the new information that you've learned.
Yes, for those that are not familiar with my case, my husband was a Mayan resistance leader, Everardo, Commander Everardo, who was captured alive by the Guatemalan army in 1992. The army literally faked his death. They wanted to torture him for his information because he had been in the mountains for so long and was of such a high rank. They realized he knew everything that they wanted to know. But they didn't want any interference from human rights groups while they tortured him. So they falsified his death, saying that he had died in combat and was buried in a certain grave. A year later, I found out that he was still alive and being severely tortured by a number of high-level military intelligence officials, including someone named Colonel Julio Roberto Alpirez. And I went down and opened the grave and, of course, found that it was not him. I then went to the State Department for literally 2 years on end, to the embassy, to the State Department, to Congress, to the United Nations. I went on 3 separate hunger strikes and finally learned that, in fact, my husband had been assassinated without a trial by the Guatemalan army, and that Colonel Julio Roberto Alpirez was very implicated in his murder. Alpirez, of course, being both a School of the Americas graduate and also a CIA-paid informant. Now, since that time, I've sued the United States government agencies for information under the Freedom of Information Act for all of the files pertaining to his death, since they apparently knew quite a bit more than they had ever told me. Throughout my hunger strikes and so on and so forth, they had always told me that they knew nothing and that there was no independent evidence that any clandestine prisoners existed. They wrote that in their letters to everyone in Capitol Hill for 2 years straight. So I sued for my files, and that's one thing I'd like to talk about today is exactly what they knew and when they knew it, because that's very startling. The other thing I'd like to talk about is a new witness who I was recently able to get out of Guatemala alive, no thanks to the Guatemalan army, and what he's been able to tell me about the interplay between an official military death squad and the North Americans or Uncle Sam.
And in terms of some of the newest information that has so far mm-hmm. not surfaced, could you give us some indications of what that is?
Yes. Like I say, there's 2 sets of information I'd like to talk about. The first one being this new witness that nearly got killed trying to leave Guatemala in November. What he has been able to tell me is that within the Army, within the G2 division, which is the military intelligence division, there are many, many secret structures, which, of course, we've always known. And he was able to draw a diagram of those secret structures. One of them is a unit called the Commando, which is simply a death squad and which has been responsible for a number of the assassinations and attacks on civilian leaders, such as Mayan resistance leaders, civil rights leaders, church leaders, et cetera, et cetera. Congress people, you name it, anyone who is a dissident within Guatemala. He said that that unit patrols throughout the country, but when they're in the capital city, the leaders of that death squad will say 2 to 3 times a week to the driver of their car, time to go check in with the blondes, or better yet, time to check in with Uncle Sam, quote unquote. They would then drive to a building just down the street from the United States Embassy, a high-rise office building, go inside and be upstairs with Uncle Sam for about 20 minutes. A very interesting coordination effort. We have a death squad coordinating with Uncle Sam. That's just terrific. He was able to name the real names and official pseudonyms of a number of people within this death squad, and he said that two of them were on the helicopter that picked my husband up at the Santa Ana Berlin military base shortly after his capture and transported him to the capital. Not only were there two death squad members on that helicopter, there was a third person. He was 6 feet tall, had light brown blondish hair, bluish eyes, blue-green eyes, and very hairy arms, very different from any southwestern Guatemalan who would, of course, be Native American. Not only that, he was wearing American combat boots. I said, how do you know he was wearing American combat boots? Well, sometimes they're issued, you know, and people get them as souvenirs. They're a different color, different lace-up patterns, and have made in the USA at the top, if you look carefully. So I said, is it possible he's one of those very rare 6-foot-tall blonde Guatemalans in American combat boots, but was really a Guatemalan pilot? And he said, no, if he was a Guatemalan pilot, he would have been required to have his military insignia on his overalls. This man had no insignia. In other words, we have an American on board a helicopter with two official death squad members picking up a secretly detained prisoner of war and transporting him from one torture center to another where he was eventually killed. This is not a matter of not screening our informants properly for human rights violations. This is direct participation. Of the two witnesses I brought out, one had been airlifted out of a combat zone in a helicopter with a Guatemalan official aboard, and the pilot was a tall, thin, red-headed person with a heavy American accent. The other person was tortured for a very long period of time. At one point, he heard a helicopter arrive on the base, and two people walked in. One was a Guatemalan. He was blindfolded, but he could hear the voice that it was Guatemalan and that it was a short person, perhaps 5'5". The other person's voice was from very high up, perhaps about a 6-foot-tall person, and he spoke with heavily American-accented Spanish. And what he wanted to know about? Cuba. What were the Cuban connections to the URNG forces? This is what the new eyewitness was able to tell me about, and I found this information not to be surprising anymore, given Sister Diana Ortiz's long efforts to bring out the truth about the close connections between torturers, assassins, and torture houses in Guatemala, and full knowledge of certain American officials. Nevertheless, I find it very shocking and very serious. What I found out from my files is equally serious. When I first found out my husband was not dead, but could still be alive, I went to the United States Department of State and to the U.S. Embassy over and over and over again. That was March of 1993. Right through till 60 Minutes on my long hunger strike, which was the end of 1994, the State Department story remained the same. The official statement was, we're very concerned about this. We're going to look into it. We've asked and asked. The Army says they don't have him. What else can we do? And we have no independent evidence that any clandestine prisoners exist. What I found in my files is the following during this 2-year period. First, when I went in to see them in March of 1993, they already had a document in their files, the State Department, from the CIA, that had also been circulated to the White House. It was dated 6 days after his capture the year before, and it said Commander Everardo has just been captured alive. The Army has not notified anyone of his capture, and they will probably fake his death to better take advantage of his intelligence. That document was never released to me. Not only that, 2 months after I went to see them, they got another document saying that he was still alive and that so were 350 other prisoners of war. They nevertheless continued to tell Congress that there was no evidence any prisoners exist. Documents continued to come in saying that he had finally been killed and that the other prisoners were being routinely tortured, held secretly, thrown out of helicopters, or stuffed down freshwater wells and buried in unmarked graves. They continued to inform Congress that there was no independent evidence that any POWs exist. The final and most tragic document is one that says Everardo, of course, is dead, which they still didn't inform me of, that he had been held in a full body cast, drugged repeatedly, and by the way, we haven't seen those other prisoners in a long time. Do you suppose they're all dead? In short, all quiet on the Western Front, thanks to the State Department.
So in other words, what these new witnesses and the documents that you've received reveal is that that there has been in Everardo's case, a systematic attempt to lie to Congress, to you, and to the American people about what degree the United States forces in Guatemala were involved in your husband's death and in all likelihood were directly involved?
There is that angle where there was a total cover-up and lying about the direct participation of United States officials and agents. But in addition to that, there was an actual blocking of any effort to rescue people whose lives could have been saved. Instead, they died horrible deaths. This was not necessary. Some of these people could have been rescued had the truth been told as soon as it was received, instead of letting 2 years elapse.
So what are you doing with this information, Jennifer Harberry?
Well, the case against the Guatemalan army goes to full international trial in June at the Inter-American Court of the OAS in Costa Rica. I do have a pending civil rights lawsuit against over 20 officials of the State Department, the White House, the U.S. Embassy, and the CIA, and I'm hoping that that will finally bring some of these practices to an end.
When you say officials of the White House and other U.S. agencies, how high up does your suit go in terms of naming names?
It goes all the way from people that would have been directly involved to the very highest officials who would have had responsibility and knowledge of these actions. And it goes, for example, all the way up to that, at that time, the Secretary of State and Anthony Lake, for example.
And in terms of people who have followed this case or are just learning about it now, what can listeners do?
Well, right now, for example, in the House, there is a pending bill requesting declassification of all human rights files for both Guatemala and Honduras, where the human rights officials are begging for that information so that they can transition into the time of peace in both of those countries. Guatemala, of course, has a truth commission that desperately needs those documents. The bill is requiring reasonable declassification of all human rights files, and it's been sponsored by Congressmen Porter and Lantos, and on the Senate side, Senator Dodd. And we'd very much urge you to call your congressperson right away and ask them to sign on to that bill. We'd really appreciate that. Thank you.
And I want to ask, in terms of the timetable, in 1995, you learned of the murder of your husband. He was captured in 1992. You're saying
yes.
That the U.S. government that you now have clear evidence of its fraudulent statements. Do you think that if the U.S. government had revealed all that it knew from the beginning, that Everardo, not to mention many other Guatemalans, but Everardo, your husband, would still be alive?
We would have had a fighting chance to get him out alive, or at least some of the others, and it would have been the first time ever that prisoners of war in Guatemala taken by the Guatemalan army would have been released alive. And that chance, that door to that opportunity was closed by the Department of State's letters, continuous 2 years' worth of letters to everyone on Capitol Hill saying, don't worry, there's no independent evidence that these people exist, despite the fact that they were getting all these reports that they did.
What has happened to Colonel Julio Roberto Alpirez since then and to the others who were involved in these death squads?
By the way, I now have the names of five people implicated in this case who are School of the Americas graduates, just by way of a parenthetical. What happened, for example, with Alpirez and a number of others is that the president of Guatemala recommended that they sue Torricelli for defamation. That didn't seem to fly very well, so they were asked to step down from the army, but they got teaching posts while it was looked into. Charges were thrown out, then on appeal brought back in. They were never arrested. They were never even arraigned. Over the 4th of July, Colonel Alpirez was reinstated with honors because there was, quote unquote, no evidence against him, unquote, even though there are a number of eyewitnesses directly involved, plus the entire CIA documentation. There was so much international outcry over that that he recently reported that he would probably retire pretty soon since he's getting old and tired. But there have been no consequences whatsoever. That is why the Inter-American Court has taken the case, a very unusual move.
Well, Jennifer Harberry, I want to thank you very much for joining us. If people want to find out more information on your case, where can they call?
I would recommend either calling my answering machine at 202-452-7428. Or they can call the Guatemala Human Rights Commission, 202-529-6599.
That's 202-452-7428. Jennifer
Correct.
Harberry, American lawyer, in search still of information about her husband, Efrain Bamaca Velasquez, also known as Comandante Everardo. Well, you've been listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! If you'd like to order a cassette copy, you can call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. Democracy Now! Is produced by Dan Coughlin, our director, Jeremy Scahill, our engineer in New York, Errol Maitland, and in Washington, Bob Daughtry. Julie Drizin is our executive producer. Our webmaster is Michelle Garcia. Thanks to Samori Marksman, Bernard White, and Alambe Brath. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez for another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! From the studios of WBAI in New York.